This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the Wisconsin governor recall election.
Money is poured into Wisconsin to try and prevent Walker from being recalled. And just remember, as you listen to this show, so goes Wisconsin, so may well go the country. A critical election.
In many classrooms around the country, girls and boys are separated based on gender stereotypes.
If you thought we were finished with that in the 50s, you'd be wrong. You remember home economics, shop, sports? Well, it seems we're back to gender stereotyping.
Quebec prepares to enforce a draconian law suppressing dissent.
In the face of that law, dissent increased.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, there are a few words we need to watch out about when we're emailing each other.
You bet. And Michael, listen to this, because you should steer clear of these words. The Electronic Privacy Information Center did a FOIA request to the Department of Homeland Security. And if you thought that the Department of Homeland Security was defending your security, you're only partly right, or maybe totally wrong, because there are hundreds of words that if you say online, the government's going to start spying on you. Michael and Heidi, I'm going to give you some tips on what words not to use. Pork.
Pork?
Pork. Clouds. Exercise. Cops. Law enforcement. Prevention. Police. Waves. Recall. Smart. Marijuana. Yemen. Somalia. Nigeria. Pakistan. Iran. Iraq.
Let's say I put that word in my subject line. That's, rather than the substance. What do they do? They have a machine that checks it?
I think they do. These are the words that people at Homeland Security are told to look out for. And then you become identified as somebody that's using these words. What do they do with it past that? I don't know. But the question I would ask them is, what right do you have to trample on our First Amendment rights to express ourselves by spying on us like this?
This is true. Just because I use the word marijuana, I could be saying, let's jail every person who smokes marijuana.
You could be saying that, Michael.
But I probably wouldn't. Or let's jail every person who eats pork.
Or goes to Mexico or sees a cloud. It's really creepy. We give a tip of the hat to the Electronic Policy Information Center for getting this list out.
Where can you check the list, Michael?
Well, you should go to the Electronic Policy Information Center's website. And
Electronic Policy or Electronic, what is it called?
Electronic Policy Information Center.
Michael, there was a recent decision in the case of Julian Assange. What happened?
Yes, Heidi. We're recording this on Wednesday, and today's the actual day when the High Court of the United Kingdom came down with a decision concerning whether or not Julian Assange should be extradited to Sweden regarding allegations of sexual abuse in Sweden. And he's been resisting it for over a year. And today the High Court, in a 5-2 decision, said that it was a lawful warrant and he had to be extradited to Sweden, not to stand trial, not to be charged, but just to be interrogated about what these two women said about what happened in Sweden. Now, what's interesting about the decision, it was on a technical point, although it's not that technical, because the court was disturbed by the European arrest warrant system. The system says that a judicial authority can issue a warrant for somebody's arrest, and then it has to be honored by the country where the person is. So Sweden issues a European arrest warrant by a, quote, judicial authority, and Julian Assange then is subject to extradition to Sweden. The issue that was raised was that in Sweden it was not a judicial authority, at least not in a traditional way, that asked for his extradition. It was a prosecutor who asked for the extradition. And that's not a neutral person. It's someone who obviously wants to prosecute Julian Assange. So that was an important issue that went up to the High Court. And if you look at the treaty and what it says and what, according to even the judges who decided this 5-2 decision, that the parliament who decided this affirmed the treaty, the European arrest warrant system, really thought judicial authority meant somebody who was a judge. But the court said, you're going to lose because it's been in practice now for a long time. Sweden is one country. There's some other countries that use the prosecutor. And because of the practice of using the prosecutor to do this, we're not going to upset what Sweden is doing, even though from our common law system, we wouldn't do this. So they, under really a much disputed decision, 5-2, decided that Julian Assange should be extradited to the United Kingdom. Now, he still has a little bit of a thread to hang on to. We'll see what they do. Because in the decision, the judges said the reason we're deciding that judicial authority can mean a prosecutor is because of the practice. And we are allowed to look at practice under a separate treaty called the Vienna Convention on Treaties. And that says you can interpret a treaty based on the practice of other countries. And unfortunately for the court, that they never argued that issue. They never asked for a brief on that issue. And of the five judges who decided against Julian Assange, three of those judges based their decision on the Vienna Convention on Treaties and the interpretation of practice. So the lawyer for Julian Assange stood up in court and said, you never asked us about this. I never briefed the issue, etc. And the court is now allowing her 2 more weeks to be able to brief that issue and see whether on this issue of using the Vienna Convention without having given the sides a chance to brief it was something they want to reconsider. I don't know what they'll do. My guess is I don't know what they'll do, actually. It's hard to say. So Julian still has a slim hope on that, maybe not so slim on that. And then if he loses that, let's say in 2 weeks they either decide they're not going to do it or they'll just say you have to be extradited anyway, then he really has to be extradited to Sweden very rapidly in a week or so. And conditions in Sweden will be very bad. People have written about what happens to people in Sweden when they're pre-trial or for interrogation. They're put into jail without bail. They can't see anybody except their lawyers at all while they're undergoing interrogation. So as Glenn Greenwald said, it's a system that borders on the, I don't know if he said medieval, but on the barbaric is what he said.
And how soon, pending this narrow reconsideration, might they move him after that's decided?
Oh, once that's decided, it's a week. He has a week to surrender and get on a plane and be taken to Sweden and put in prison. And of course, the fears here are, and it was stated by a number of people today, the fears here are that it will be much easier for the U.S. to extradite Julian Assange for espionage to the United States from Sweden than it is from the United Kingdom. It's the laws a little bit, it's the skill of the lawyers, but it's also Sweden's a smaller country, you can just bat around more easily. And in fact, interestingly enough, Hillary Clinton, who has never visited Sweden, is flying to Sweden. I think she's getting there on June 1st. So that's a very suspicious circumstance, right? That the very week that it was to be decided about his extradition, that she is going to Sweden. And she has been, the State Department has been heavily after Julian Assange.
Michael, how does this tie in with the Bradley Manning trial?
WikiLeaks is allegedly the site where Bradley Manning uploaded millions of documents from called the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, the collateral murder videotape, and of course all the State Department cables. So they're trying Bradley Manning right now on a courts martial for aiding the enemy, which carries a life sentence, potentially even a death penalty. That's going on at Fort Meade. And of course, WikiLeaks, but Julian Assange in particular, seems to be even more of a target in a certain way than Bradley Manning. I mean, Bradley Manning's in a bad way there. I mean, they want to, as his lawyer said, they want to get him to testify against Julian Assange. They want to give him, 40, 50 years in prison if he doesn't. Whether he knows anything about Julian Assange is completely unclear. Probably doesn't know very much, if anything, because these were just uploaded to a website. So the Bradley Manning trial is continuing. The next dates for the motions in the trial are June 6th, 7th, and 8th, 3 days at Fort Meade. My office, the Center for Constitutional Rights, has been monitoring those trials on behalf, really, of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange to make sure, one, that Bradley's rights are protected, but also so that any information that might come out that's relevant to WikiLeaks, we would have a bead on it. The problem is very little is public in that trial. Yeah, I can sit in the trial, but none of the motions are public, except now some of the defense motions, but none of the government's motions. The court orders are not public. You can't get the papers, and therefore you can't understand the case. So what we did at the center 2 weeks ago, we filed papers demanding that we get documents from the court and they be made public, not just for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, but for the public and the media. The judge denied us everything, and now it's on the Military Court of Appeals, and then we'll be going up if we lose that to the Armed Forces Appeals Court and ultimately to federal court. So we have that going on. What's you know, shocking is, you know, here you get a guy who is the very justification for what Bradley Manning allegedly did was the secrecy of this government in its war crimes, and now they're keeping his trial secret. So it's all bad.
Is there a Bradley Manning Defense Committee?
Yes, it's called the Bradley Manning Support Committee. People should go onto the website. It's really important. It hasn't gotten the publicity recently that it should have. People should go to Fort Meade. There's a demonstration outside the gate every day during the week, or at least check on that website. And a number of us actually go into the courtroom or into the media room.
And it's called the Bradley Manning Support Committee?
Yes.
This week was a crucial week for Wisconsin and the rest of the country because of the June 5th recall election in Wisconsin of Governor Scott Walker. Since February of last year, Wisconsin's capital of Madison has been filled with demonstrations, mass mobilizations, and an amazing amount of citizen activism that has led up to the recall. The recall came after some 30,000 volunteers throughout the state gathered more than 1 million signatures on recall petitions. The recall will show whether the people of Wisconsin have the ability to control their own destiny against a massive amount of outside money that's poured into the state in support of Walker. Governor Walker has made deep, deep cuts in public education. He's taken away the right of public workers to bargain in unions that are mostly women. He's gone after reproductive rights and compromised the state's environmental policies. We're joined today by Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive magazine, to talk about what Wisconsin politics means to the rest of the country. Ruth, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Ruth, you're in the heart of where this really critical recall election is going on in Wisconsin. Give us some sense of what's going on there.
Well, I mean, what's going on is sort of the culmination of a year and a half of grassroots rebellion in Wisconsin against the corporate takeover of our state. And it's been a really dramatic time here, beginning when Walker, in his own words, dropped the bomb by ending public employees' collective bargaining rights, and continuing on with the biggest cuts to our public schools in Wisconsin we've ever seen, you know, huge cuts to our university system and our technical college system, pretty much the elimination of a national model Department of Natural Resources, where we now have a right-wing blogger who used to work for the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, which is a business lobby firm, writing about how she despises regulation. She now runs our DNR. You know, mass retirements of public employees who did everything from being public defenders to school teachers. You know, it's just been kind of out and out war on society here. And what we've seen in response to this very radical right-wing takeover of our state is, you know, a democratic movement that is almost unprecedented, you know, with hundreds of thousands of people coming out in these mass rallies a year ago. And now this grassroots petition drive, which was not really sanctioned by or directed by the Democratic Party, either nationally or in our state, but was just, you know, there was so much pressure from grassroots volunteers and neighborhood groups who gathered over 1 million signatures to recall our governor, and now we're going to have an election.
Ruth, tell us especially about the role of women in this. For one thing, the attacks that Walker's made on women's rights, the role of the women in the unions that he's gone after, nurses, teachers. What's so special about that?
Well, I mean, the phrase war on women resonates in Wisconsin, you know, as it does nationally. But, you know, here in Wisconsin, Walker has, you know, he's always been a very hardcore pro-life politician from his earliest days in politics. And he actually wrote a piece of legislation that would allow individual pharmacists to decide whether to dispense birth control to women. And he's pushed through a variety of his agenda items that include closing Planned Parenthood clinics across our state, which provide basic health care, often the only health care provider to rural women in Wisconsin. He's closed 9 Planned Parenthood clinics. He has criminalized abortion doctors whose patients fail to jump through some fairly onerous hoops, which has made medical abortion a thing of the past in Wisconsin. He rolled back our pay equity law here so women can no longer sue for equal pay. I mean, it's just been sort of an all-out attack. And as you point out, you know, early on with the attack on public employees, And the whole middle class in Wisconsin, a lot of the people who were most affected were women, because these tend to be a lot of the, you know, the teachers and nurses, and even state employees who just have jobs that don't pay particularly well, but they afford good benefits and job security and family time. They tend to be female-dominated professions. So it's been, I think women in particular have been hurt by Walker's agenda and have led a lot of the rebellion against Walker.
We're speaking with Ruth Conniff of the Progressive magazine in Wisconsin on the recall. So, Ruth, give us a little more overview. There's the recall, and I know they got a million signatures to get the recall, I think. And then there's all kinds of contested Senate elections or something else going on as well. Is it the same time? Give us a little overview of what's going on in these elections.
Well, in addition to trying to recall the governor and the lieutenant governor of the state, there are drives to recall four Republican state senators who have been among the people who've helped to push through Scott Walker's agenda in Wisconsin. So in the summertime, there was a first round of recall elections, actually, and it narrowed the Republican majority in our state Senate to a single vote. So while the Democrats did not take control of the Senate, it slowed down a lot of the proposals that the Republicans were pushing through, including privatization push in our school system here. So if the Democrats are able to win one of these four contested seats in these recall elections, they will take control of the state Senate.
The recall election is happening for the senators at the same time as the Governor Walker recall?
Yes, it's all on the same day.
So even if the recall was lost with regard to Walker, in other words, he remained in power, you might well get control of the Senate, or the Democrats might, which would at least be able to stop some of the worst excesses, I guess.
Yeah, I think it could further slow this really aggressive push, multi-front push to, you know, privatize, to deregulate, and to attack our democracy, you know, with the voter ID bills. With, you know, a lot of these are ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council bills, that are being pushed nationally in states across the country. But in Wisconsin, Walker, who himself is a member of ALEC, and where we have a number of ALEC members in our state legislature, it's been particularly aggressive. So we've seen this multi-front push on all of these pro-corporate, anti-democracy bills.
Ruth, what you alluded to before, I wanted to expand on what's been the relationship between the National Democratic Party and the events in Wisconsin.
Well, you know, Barack Obama has not spent a whole lot of time in Wisconsin. It took him a year to even visit after the mass rallies here. There is currently a drive to try to get him to come to the state in the last closing days before the recall election and barnstorm. There's a sense that the grassroots is really dragging the party leadership along on this. And I think the Obama campaign made a decision a long time ago that they would rather focus on reelecting Obama than get terribly involved in the recall of our governor here. So there was a piece in the Washington Post in which state Democratic Party officials were complaining that the DNC had not put a whole lot of money into Wisconsin. But I guess how you feel about that depends on where you sit, because, you know, the fact is this is really a fight over democracy and whether citizens have a voice in their democracy. I think, unfortunately, the Obama campaign doesn't see the upside for them in taking advantage of this incredible grassroots operation in Wisconsin. You know, I mean, I don't mean that in terms of something that's imposed from above, but just that people are terribly, terribly interested and involved. We're expecting turnout on a par with a presidential election for this recall race. And furthermore, there are 30,000 volunteers who gathered signatures to recall the governor. There were, as you point out, a million people who signed the petitions. There are a lot of really activated folks all over the state. Neighborhood organizations are involved, you know, people going door to door. So the Obama campaign has not really seen fit to support that or see it as potential benefit in the long run for the fall election, and that's too bad. But, you know, this thing is really being driven inside Wisconsin by Wisconsinites. I think if it's going to succeed, it's going to succeed because of that incredible enthusiasm and energy on the ground.
One question is about money. You've talked a lot about democracy and the grassroots effort, particularly among the Democrats, I presume the Republicans as well. But we read a little bit here in New York about the amount of money that is poured into Wisconsin, particularly from the Walker forces. What effect is that having? Do you see it very visibly? What's going on that issue?
Sure. I just went out and moved my car, and I heard a radio ad that connects Tom Barrett, Walker's opponent, the mayor of Milwaukee, with criminals in Milwaukee who are threatening to, you know, beat their girlfriends and kill their babies. I mean, the ad war here is unbelievable. It's, you know, it's the money that is pouring into TV and radio advertising is incredible. And Walker has raised as much money as a second-tier presidential candidate. He's raised as much money as a Newt Gingrich or a Rick Santorum, $30.1 million in the most recent filing. A lot of it from out of state, 60 to 70% of it from out of state. Some of the same billionaires who are floating those second-tier Republican presidential candidates, Foster Freeze and Sheldon Adelson, are floating the Scott Walker campaign. On Barrett's side, there's less money. I mean, it was, you know, he was outspent 20 to 1 when he started just after the Democratic primary. This is a very compressed election. So May 8th was the Democratic primary. There are groups, progressive groups like the PCCC, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. That group just put $100,000 into helping to get out the vote in Wisconsin, and they stated when they did that that they were disappointed that the DNC hadn't put more money into Wisconsin. They turned down a request by the state party here, the state Democratic Party, for $500,000 investment in that get out the vote drive. I mean, the big difference between the two sides, in addition to just this huge imbalance in the millions of dollars on the Walker side versus the, you know, handful of millions of dollars, tens of millions versus, you know, millions on the Barrett side, is that the money on the Barrett side is mostly coming from inside Wisconsin, and the reverse is true on Walker's side.
Walker's been quoted as saying, this is our time to change the course of history. What's your take on whether what happens in Wisconsin is going to change what goes on in other states as well?
I think it's critically important because it's really a test of whether it's possible for there to be a real democratic pushback against corporate takeover of government in the Citizens United era. And I do think it's a fundamental ideological battle. I mean, it's a battle, you know, between this, you know, citizens uprising and the incredible power of all this money. But also ideologically, Paul Ryan, who's also from Wisconsin, the congressman who wrote the, you know, famous budget plan that slashes programs for the poor, has said that progressivism, you know, progressive politics came out of Wisconsin. The progressive movement was founded in Wisconsin over a century ago. And this battle between sort of the progressive view of politics and the conservative view is coming to a head in Wisconsin this year. And I think that's true. I think what's at stake ideologically is this question of whether we're going to live in a society where we invest in our schools. We have a great public school system in Wisconsin. We're just slashing the heck out of it now. Whether we're going to have a middle class, whether we believe that we can provide those kinds of supports to people and we can pool our resources and have a decent society, or whether we're going to have this real go-it-alone mentality where there's basically no check on corporate power and we, you know, attack unions and disempower people and, you know, have a pretty stark, brutal view of, you know, austerity and inequality.
Robert La Follette and the Progressive Movement, which was a third-party movement, do you think that the resistors to Walker's cutbacks have had their hands tied because it's been done within the channel of the Democratic Party?
Well, I don't know if people's hands were tied. There was a lot of debate early on about whether, instead of the electoral strategy that's unfolded and that's really coming to a peak here with the recall election, there should have been a general strike. So there was real debate among labor unions about whether or not to call for a general strike, and they decided not to do that. So, I mean, I think it's a, you know, it's a multi-front attack, and I think the electoral part is a piece of it. And then, you know, there's a question about, you know, what else can be done to raise awareness and to, you know, resist what's happening in Wisconsin. I don't know if people's hands were tied so much as they were. There was this really spontaneous thing that happened with these mass rallies. It wasn't such a coordinated, planned event, and it was incredibly thrilling to be part of that. I mean, I was there with my kids and their teachers, and you know, I saw my kid's gym teacher wiggle in a first floor window when the Capitol was locked so she could get inside.
That's great.
With this huge group of people who were protesting the, you know, the fact that they were ramming through the union busting bill in the assembly without giving adequate notice and allowing Democrats to vote. You know, there was this real outpouring that, and channeling that energy and deciding what to do with it has been, you know, a question all along. But, you know, I think there's going to be another phase. I think this has really been a huge wake-up call to middle-class people who, you know, have absorbed this message from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party to a large degree over many years, that what we need are tax breaks for corporations and prosperity will trickle down and you'll be fine. And what we see here is just this shocking attack on the public sector and the public sphere. And to give one small example, by reopening something called the Las Vegas loophole in Wisconsin, which allows corporations here to hide their profits out of state and pay no corporate income tax, our state has lost exactly the same amount of money that Walker took out of our technical college system. So we are transferring, you know, wealth to corporations. And of course, Wisconsin has been last for job creation in the whole nation under Walker's tenure. So I think just really seeing what a bad idea these Republican nostrums about tax breaks for the job creators really are has woken people up. And I don't think that it's going to end with this recall election.
We're speaking with Ruth Conniff of The Progressive about the recall election in Wisconsin. And just give us a summary of what's at stake and who the people are that are the attempted recalls.
Well, I think the thing that's going to be really critical is get out the vote. So right now, polls of Wisconsin voters have gone from showing Walker with about a 6-point lead to dead even. And it's really, the question is going to be turnout. It's going to be, you know, which side gets people to the polls. It's going to be a nail biter. We don't know who's going to win. It's going to be really close. It's a closely divided state. On the Senate side, if the Democrats are able to win one of these four elections, that will be a significant setback for Walker. What's at stake really is undoing the damage in Wisconsin is going to take a lot of time, but I think one thing that's at stake is just symbolically whether or not citizens can reclaim their democracy in the Citizens United era from this, you know, nationally coordinated corporate assault. And whether Walker wins or loses, and whether a couple of these entrenched Republican allies of his lose their jobs after June 5th is going to send a very strong message one way or another to the rest of the country.
Ruth, I know you're a writer for The Progressive. Is there a place our listeners can go to look at your writing and The Progressive that's online?
Yep. Yeah, our website is www.progressive.org, and we are following this thing very closely.
Well, thank you, Ruth Conniff from The Progressive, and good luck in the election.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ruth.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Single-gender classes may violate federal law by relying on gender stereotypes. That's what the ACLU is saying about classes in several states, including Massachusetts, Indiana, Ohio, Washington, Illinois, and Maine. The Maine ACLU is calling for the Sanford School District there to stop offering single-gender classes, which they say may violate Title IX, the federal law that addresses gender equity in federally funded education programs. Examples of improper gender stereotypes include sixth grade girls discussing current events over cocoa, while boys create an exercise area in the classroom and earn points toward prizes from the National Football League. The ACLU has submitted requests for public records and is reviewing records or has pending requests in other states, including Alabama, Wisconsin, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. Zachary Hayden, legal director for the ACLU of Maine, joins us to talk more about their action. Zachary, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us, what's the problem with these single-gender classes?
Well, all children are entitled to equal access to education, regardless of their sex. That's what the law says. That's what the Constitution says. And these same-sex classrooms have a danger of reinforcing stereotypes about learning. They separate kids out by sex and then apply these outmoded stereotypes in terms of how they conduct those classes. And that's really, it does a terrible disservice to boys and girls.
Give us some examples of what those stereotypes are. Like when I was a kid in the 50s, it was home economics for girls, shop for boys, etc. I presume it's not that stark, but maybe it is.
It is, in fact, just about that stark. So one example we found here in Maine, we did a public documents request about a school in Sanford, Maine, that was operating same-sex classes in the sixth grade. And we wanted to learn more about their program, so we asked for all the records, all the documents they had. And we got a newsletter where the teachers were talking about the program, so talking about the boys' classes and the girls' classes. In the boys' classes, the boys have signed up for this exercise program called NFL Experience, where the boys could do a lot of exercise in the morning, and they earn different points depending on how much exercise they do and what kinds of exercise. In the girls' class, no NFL experience. The girls, what they do in the morning is have hot cocoa and read the local newspaper and discuss current events. So I want to go on the record, though, just to be clear. I think cocoa and exercise are wonderful in moderation, and that they could both play important roles in education. But the idea that boys need exercise and girls need cocoa and quiet discussion time is something that we thought we'd left behind decades ago.
What do you say when someone argues that single-gender classes provide fewer distractions, make students feel comfortable and less afraid, perhaps, to take risks?
I think there's lots of things that can be distracting to students and lots of things that can be comforting to students. The danger, though, is the idea of relying on these generalizations that boys are going to be distracted by certain things and girls are going to be distracted by other things, or boys are going to feel more comfortable in certain environments and girls will feel more comfortable in others. Those generalizations are going to be true in some instances, but they're going to be not true in others. And that's the danger of overbroad generalizations.
What's the age groupings that this is happening to?
We're seeing it across the country, and this is something the ACLU Women's Rights Project has been looking into all over the country, and middle school, high school, and even some elementary school programs.
Zach, are they saying that boys and girls learn differently and think differently?
That's exactly what they're saying. There's a national organization that's been promoting these same-sex programs around the country, and they have these totally unscientific ideas about how boys and girls learn, how their brains develop. And the scientific literature is very clear that same-sex classes don't actually connect well with the developmental physiology of boys or girls. They don't match up to the science. But nonetheless, this sort of unscientific ideas have made their way into the classroom, and that's what they're using to teach.
I'm curious, are there examples in which a girl from a certain school may have wanted to be included in the boys' section and wasn't allowed to?
There was an example of that here on our staff at the ACLU of Maine when we were discussing this program as an advocacy project. One of the women on our team said, when I was a girl, I would have given anything to be in a class where I could have exercised more and been more active and had exercise. And one of the men on our staff said, I would have loved to have that class where I could sit around, not be around a bunch of other boys, but just be around girls and talk and sip hot cocoa. That would have been an ideal class for me. And we're seeing that play out across the country where, people object to these programs because they are being excluded. And that's what Title IX says. You can't exclude students from educational programs on the basis of sex.
Now, I thought we were making important gains, for example, in the field of sports, where increasingly girls and women were being allowed to be on boys' teams. Or why hasn't that carried over to these classroom scenarios?
I think that is true. And I think that for the most part, what we're seeing, that the large trajectory of public education in this country has been towards breaking down these stereotypes of more opportunities for girls, really, who had been traditionally excluded because of these stereotypes in the sports arena and in the academic arena, recognition that, you know, girls can play just as hard as boys and succeed on the same playing field. But there's still this developing problem that we felt like we had to deal with that's running against that, this counter trend of the expansion of these same-sex segregated classrooms.
Do you see this tied to larger political trends around the country?
You know, that's a really good question. We're worried about that. And these schools, when you do the public documents request and look at the literature, they are, you know, programs that are based not just on unscientific views about learning, but, you know, dangerous stereotypes about how boys and girls ought to behave. The problems in the classroom are bad enough, but the idea that this is going to lead to a reinforcing of old gender norms and standards is really something that got our attention and got the attention of the ACLU Women's Rights Project.
You mentioned that it's happening in more than Maine. Can you give us some sense of the extent this is happening or being replicated, and then what the ACLU is doing about it?
The big event that's happened recently was a sort of coordinated launching of public documents requests around the country to find out more about what's going on in different states. And so Maine has been a part of that. I gave you one example, the NFL versus Hot Cocoa example. But there are examples like that from all over the country. In Wood County, West Virginia, for example, the girls sit in their classroom in circular tables, and the boys sit in rows, which, okay, that doesn't seem too bad. But then you look at the reasoning why they do that, and the reason why is because boys, if they had to, according to this school, if they had to sit in circular tables, they would have to look at each other in the face, and boys, apparently, if they have to look at each other in the eyes, they will become aggressive. So that's what they're telling the boys in Wood County, West Virginia. If you have to look at somebody else in the eye of your same sex, then you're going to become aggressive.
But it's like the same kind of science the Scopes trial was based on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
that's true about bears. So I guess it makes sense, right?
And there you go. Right. And so, you know, Polk County, Florida, there are documents about how girls, if they're having problems doing their homework on time or things, that the teacher should talk to them about their feelings and their emotions. Boys, instead, the teachers are told that they need to discipline the boys forcefully and to use a loud voice. So that's, you know, how it's getting played out in Florida.
Is there a trend in these schools where this is happening? Any conclusions you can draw about the kind of institutions they are? Or the kind of environment, location?
You know, that's a really good question. We've seen it in so many different places. And I can tell you, you know, I grew up in Florida, and now I live here in Maine. Polk County, Florida, and York County, Maine could not be more different. And yet, these ideas about learning and segregating students out by sex have taken root in both of them. I think it's, you know, a lot of sort of a fluke of what schools latch onto these ideas and bring them into the classroom, but they are part of this national agenda, organizations that are promoting these traditional sex roles and trying to sort of reestablish a lot of old stereotypes that we thought we'd gotten beyond.
Zachary, I don't want to sound paranoid, but is there any kind of national think tank or legislative recommendation outfit that we've seen so influential in other parts of the country that's trying to coordinate this nationally?
There is, in fact. There's a national organization that promotes same-sex education. It was started by a retired pediatrician named Leonard Sachs. And they are a well-funded outfit, and they have put out a lot of promotional material. They have a website. They send material to schools encouraging them to adopt same-sex classes, you know, in their programs, in their schools. And schools have bought into that. They've bought into a lot of the justification. And Dr. Sachs's outfit, for example, says girls don't learn well under pressure. They don't respond well to deadlines. So if you're having a classroom, your girls' classroom, you shouldn't have a lot of work under time pressure, a lot of deadlines, because girls can't handle it.
The craziest thing. It's actually opposite of my experiences.
Right.
But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But the girls always had their homework in on time, or at least most of them.
That's right.
Many of them.
You know, but what could happen is this sort of thing becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
If you start telling girls from a young age, right, oh, you don't respond well under pressure, guess what? They're not going to learn how to deal with pressure as well, and that is dangerous.
So have you guys started to litigate this yet?
Yeah, there's been some litigation already in Tennessee and in Louisiana, and there's the potential for a lot more because there's, you know, both Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause prohibit this sort of thing. So I think we've laid it out to a number of schools around the country now as this advocacy project has expanded, that you need to shape this up or there's going to be some litigation.
I just have another question going back to the organization that's sending out information encouraging this. Have you looked into their funding sources?
I haven't. It's a really. It would be interesting to know more about it, but it does seem that they have common purpose with many of the social conservative movement organizations that are promoting return to traditional values. And so it would be interesting to know whether there's overlap in their funding.
And in terms of your document requests, have most schools been cooperating in turning things over?
Yeah, they so far they have. I mean, sometimes it takes a little more pressure. Here in Maine, they cooperated very freely. I think in other places it takes a little bit more pressure to get the public documents that are necessary. But it's an ongoing process, and I think it's going to be one that's expanded across the country. The ACLU, as you all know, has offices in almost every state, and so are hoping to try to look into these programs as they are expanding across the country and try to put a stop to them.
Zachary Hayden from the ACLU of Maine, can you give us a website if our listeners want to learn more about what you folks are doing?
Yeah, the place to go is the ACLU.org. And our Women's Rights Project has a whole separate page set up called Teach Kids Not Stereotypes. So if you go to ACLU.org and click on the Women's Rights Project, that should take you right there. And they have their, examples of the public documents requests that we've sent around the country, and they have some, models available. And this is something people, if they're interested in your community, that you can do yourself. You don't need to be a lawyer to do a public documents request. Anybody has the right to ask for these documents, and you can ask your local schools about them, find out if they are having sex segregated programs and why they're doing it. Another thing people could do is get in touch with their local school boards, and this is something you can reach out to them and let them know that these stereotypes about sex don't have any place in your local schools.
Zachary Hayden, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Heidi. Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, thanks. Michael. Good luck to you on this project.
Thank you all. Have a great day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Austerity is taking its toll in many countries as public services are cut, federal jobs are slashed, and tuition hikes are pushed on to the younger generations. Canada is no exception. For the past 3 months, students in Montreal, Quebec have poured into the streets, inspiring many others to join them in waging a massive strike against rising college tuition fees. Last week, the government proposed an offer to end the strike, but student leaders have so far refused to recommend the deal. Meanwhile, the Quebec government introduced an emergency legislation bill 78. The bill would suspend the academic year and make demonstrations of more than 50 people illegal unless police had been served with an itinerary 8 hours in advance. The new law, however, has not stopped the unpredictable pots and pans demonstrations, as protesters on balconies around the city make noise to express solidarity in opposing tuition hikes. We get an update on the police violence and Bill 78 from Amnesty International Canada Francophone Branch Director Beatrice Vaugrand. Beatrice, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
We're thrilled to see events unfolding in Montreal. I have the same kind of optimistic feeling that we had when Occupy Wall Street sprung up here in New York City. Tell us, what are the origins of the movement in Montreal and what's been happening?
For now, 15 weeks, we can say that, the students' organizations are in the streets to denounce a recent Quebec decision to raise university fees by 75% for 5 years. So these student organizations, which are organized by assembly and decision by the majority, have decided to be on strike, to not attend the classes. So for 15 weeks, they've been in the streets to denounce this sharp raise of the university fees, and they tried to oblige the government to go back and review the decision. So it's been very for a long moment. You can realize that 15 weeks is a long time. So apparently the government did not decide to listen to the students' organizations' requirements. So the strikes went on in Montreal in other cities of Quebec, of the province of Quebec. Some, unfortunately, acts of violence happened that Amnesty condemned. It includes as well potential arbitrary detention. So we shoot as well, and we ask for an independent inquiry. Finally, the government did meet with the students' organization, but the proposed solutions, they in fact proposed something which looked like 82% of raise, but spread over 7 years instead of 5 years. So it didn't really please the students' organizations, and there were all their solutions, but it was not agreed by the students' organization. So, and the government on May 18th did vote in a very hasty manner about a new bill called Bill 78, which in different articles really is worrying about right to assembly, freedom of expression. This bill, on the government point of view, was to bring back the calm in the different cities of Montreal and allow some students to attend some classes, because not all the students are against the university fees raise. So some wanted to attend the classes and could not because the students inscribed were front of the door. So this bill, objective of the bill, was to allow apparently some students to go back to be able to attend their class. But unfortunately, this bill is really going much beyond the objective of the bill and sharpen the right of assembly, freedom of expression.
Beatrice, didn't the student outpouring attract more than just students and serve really as an occasion to excite public response?
There were several analyses, obviously, about what kind of political and economic lecture we can do about these strikes. Definitely, the main objective is the student, the university fees. But the current government of Quebec is under scrutiny for several initiatives, economic and initiative raise. For example, Plan Nord, which is an economic plan to develop the north of Quebec, which seems to give great power to some mining companies. So these North plans is criticized, and Amnesty belongs to a coalition actually to protect indigenous rights people, and we said not enough was made to protect indigenous rights people in this plan, for example. This government as well is under scrutiny for corruption allegations, so there is a special commission about this. So we can say that this belongs to the context as well of people being angered. Definitely since the adoption of Bill 78, you have what we call the pan effect, les casseroles.
Well, let's talk about Bill 78. What was it trying to accomplish against the student movement?
The Bill 78 was aimed to bring back the calm in the cities and to allow some students to attend their class. So it really hit hard on the right of freedom of assembly and association, the right to freedom of expression, the right to the presumptions of innocence. So it hit hard these student organizations, and they are subject to heavy and sharp fines if they are too close or prevent university activities in their strikes. So this is really a big concern as well. This bill goes beyond just the students' activities. It raises some huge concerns about the right to peaceful demonstration, and it concerns all organizations. So they have very specific rules you need to give to the police in advance. So in fact, even somebody being in the streets and participating to a demonstration who seems to, for example, he wants to follow that demonstration because it appeals, the message appeals to him or her, then could be, in fact, in an illegal demonstration and doesn't even know about it. So nobody now, people feel some fears to participate to a demonstration because they don't know if they're allowed to. Could they be pursued because of the participation, or they even have shared the information of a potential demonstration somewhere by sharing information on social media, for example. So there are many, many dispositions and articles in this bill which go further than just, are not permissible under provincial, national, and international human rights law.
Can you talk a bit about the police violence that you saw, and do you suspect the use of agents provocateur?
We don't know. Actually, Amnesty did not do an independent and in-depth inquiry about the police possible potential act of violence. In fact, we received many, many testimonies, videos, and we have read carefully as well some media reports about this. So enough for us to ask for an independent inquiry. We do know that the act of vandalism as well were made by some individuals in the demonstration. But we've seen by some apparently clear videos that police used what we call tools for controlling audiences of all people in the streets when they are in the demonstrations, like pepper spray or gas tear or coup de baton and matraque. Some just on May 23rd, but it happened as well in many weeks, we had 500 people arrested in the streets. So you may assume that some of them are arbitrary detention. So we really want, as Amnesty, the Quebec government to carry on an independent inquiry. As for provocative agents, we have no information about this. It has been demonstrated in past events in Quebec that police used the provocative agents within the demonstrators. But for the time being, regarding the student strikes, it has not been proved.
What's the population of Montreal?
1 million, if we take just the city of Montreal.
So one out of every five citizens are out on the streets. That's quite amazing. Beatrice Vagrant, we appreciate the good work of Amnesty International in Canada, and we're grateful for you to be on Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Thanks for the invitation again. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.